Welcome back from Sabbath.
I'm a calm and collected busy beaver.
Yeah, good. I gotta make sure I know what number this workshop is so I can do my duty.
Oh yeah, it's something. I wrote it down.
Let's see, this is
319.
Is that what it is? 319 is?
You can double check. I do have
The online one doesn't have those numbers, so I'll just take your word for it.
Is that right?
Yeah, this is 319.
Sweet.
That's what I have too.
Welcome, everybody. You are in the Friday afternoon, June 26th, General Assembly Workshop number 319, entitled Congregational Conflict Through a Buddhist Lens. I am Reverend Wayne Arneson. I'm a member of the board of the Unitarian Universalist Buddhist Fellowship and convener of a small panel of Unitarian Universalists who practice Buddhism, who will be offering some reflections today and some conversation with you on how the moral and ethical precepts of Buddhism can illuminate and offer skillful means for engaging with conflict in our congregations and, I guess for that matter, our lives as a whole. Later in the workshop, we will take some time to introduce other members of the Unitarian Universalist Buddhist Fellowship Board of Trustees and let you know about the scope of our resources and publications. We will do a commercial for a book that Reverend Sam Trumbore and I published about Buddhist voices in Unitarian Universalism, a few copies of which are available for sale at the door, but I won't do that now. Instead, jumping right to the topic of the day for the benefit of people listening online, let me introduce my fellow panelists. Janine Larson has been serving since 2004 as...
This mic is on.
Can you hear me?
Oh, you should get closer.
We're on. Okay. Been serving since 2004 as the district executive for the Pacific Northwest District of the UUA, but with the transition into regions... Okay, so I'm being given instruction here. People in the back, can you hear me? Okay, hands up. Okay, so I think my mic is on loud enough. I think I'm good. All right. With the transition into regions, that title has disappeared, and she continues to serve as a member of the Congregational Life staff in the Pacific Western region and is deeply grateful for her work with the PNWD's volunteer Healthy Congregations team in teaching effective communications and positive conflict engagement. Over to her right is the Reverend Rick Davis, who has been the senior minister of the UU Church of Salem, Oregon since 1993. And Rick, in the course of his career, has supported and advised his colleagues and congregations in both formal roles and informal ways as they have encountered conflicts. And as I said, I'm Wayne Arneson. I'm the co-minister of the West Shore Unitarian Universalist Church near Cleveland, Ohio, and I'm the outgoing chair of the Ministerial Fellowship Committee and occasionally have seen a few conflicts cross my desk in that role. Each of us are committed Unitarian Universalists who have practiced Buddhism in our own lives as a spiritual grounding and as rules for the road of our living. And I think it's fair to say that each of us has been drawn to Buddhism, not so much as a doctrinal explanation for the great questions of life, but as a time-tested way of life that leads to a deeper appreciation of the gifts that life offers us. Our format today is going to include no more than 15 minutes of reflection from each of us, and then 20 minutes, maybe more, of engagement with mostly you, maybe a little with each other, around your questions or comments. And at the end, I hope you'll indulge us with maybe 10 minutes to tell you a little bit more about the UU Buddhist Fellowship, and especially our plans for a West Coast convocation in the spring of 2017. So let me begin by saying a little bit about the Buddhist precepts, since I'm guessing that many of you are probably more familiar with congregational conflict than you are with the precepts. The precepts are the moral and ethical teachings of Buddhism, and they are held within the Four Noble Truths that Buddha articulated as the summary of his teaching and that so many people are casually familiar with. The fourth of the Four Noble Truths is the one that describes the way that leads to the relieving of suffering in this life. Suffering, of course, broadly understood, not just physical pain, but the suffering of our impermanence. Through eight ways of being in the world that are referred to as the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path gets divided into three groupings: wisdom, concentration, and morality. And it is within the morality grouping that we find the basis for the precepts. Within the Eightfold Path, the three morality teachings have to do with right speech, right actions, and right livelihood. The more detailed list of the precepts can be understood as subsets or unpacking of these three: right speech, right action, and right livelihood. So I've got a handout, and as being sort of green and sort of lazy, I probably don't have enough for every one of us here. So I'm going to ask for some help from an avid volunteer or two who could step up and distribute these down the two sides and hope that you can share them. I've got probably 40. Sorry about that. Thanks, Mike. Thank you. Yeah, you know, share. Some of you are more avid about looking at these all together. They're not hard to find on the internet if we had a Wi-Fi signal in this building somewhere. So you could look for them there. So the English translations of the precepts can vary within different Buddhist traditions. If you're a practitioner and you've seen these in different forms, par for the course. But this version is from Zen Mountain Monastery in New York State, which is the first place I studied in some depth, and it's as good as any. And it begins with the three refuges that each Buddhist affirms. And so you'll notice that the Sangha, the third of the three refuges, which is the community of practitioners, is one of these three important refuges. So as complex and sometimes conflict-ridden as communities can be, it is valued. Sangha is valued equally with the Buddha, the teacher, and with the teachings, the Dharma. A lot of Western meditators don't necessarily study the life of Buddha other than knowing a few of the major well-known stories about his initial process of moving towards enlightenment. So many people are not aware of the fact that the Buddha's original Sangha had some serious conflicts that he had to deal with. You know, he taught for what, 35, 40 years, something like that, after his enlightenment. And he lived in a world of, feudal is a European word, but he lived in a world of kings and princes that supported and sheltered spiritual teachers. That was how they stayed alive, made a living. They had patrons. And so he had to deal with, over the course of his life, the politics of that whole dynamic. And his most severe conflict within the Sangha came when Buddha was 72 years old. You know, you'd think he'd be feeling like, oh boy, I'm almost retired. I've really got it down now about how to operate this community. But at 72 years old, his own cousin and brother-in-law, Devadatta, decided that he was the guy who was going to be qualified to succeed Buddha. And he plotted against him and finally decided to sort of test his strength by taking on Buddha around the issue of the Sangha's ethical standards. Devadatta proposed a stricter monastic discipline for the Sangha. Now, this was a Sangha that was already surviving essentially through the gifts of others and through the patronage of a particular king. And David Dada proposed that they should be even harder on themselves in terms of how they received gifts, how they were supported, what they ate. Essentially, it was kind of a fundamentalist call, a more fundamentalist interpretation of monastic discipline. And it attracted followers within Buddhist Sangha, who I think were feeling some anxiety about succession. You know, this guy's not going to live forever, and what's going to happen, and we need to tighten up. Does this sound familiar?
Yeah.
And Buddhist Sangha split in two. It took lengthy, serious conversation and negotiation, monk by monk, to bring the Sangha back together. But they did it. And Devadatta's severity and his ambition was discredited one conversation at a time. So one conversation at a time is a good way to think about resolving church conflict, because that's usually what it takes. In a recent book of meditations about UU leaders and leadership that was edited by Kay Montgomery, a lovely book, I don't know how many of you have seen it, but it's available in the bookstore, I contributed a much less poetic piece than others about the three poisons that Buddhist teachers warn against that can reflect common traps that congregational leaders will encounter. And the three poisons in Buddhism are described as greed, anger, and ignorance. Anger and ignorance we can understand pretty easily. Greed, I think, refers to wanting something that you can't have or that would be very difficult to get in the context of the community. And all three of the poisons were involved in the efforts that Devadatta made to split the Sangha for his own aggrandizement. The three poisons can be very subtle, and they can operate routinely and quietly in everyday leadership as you compete for scarce resources, we all know about that in church, or to achieve goals that you can envision and strongly believe in, but that maybe other leaders in the church can't see. Anger in leadership, for me personally, is the toughest poison. It can be described as a reflexive effort to dominate a situation to achieve the ends you desire. I'm a good minister. I don't do things like that, except when I really kind of lose control and forget about the fact that that what that really represents is anger as a poison. Anger can be visible and obvious, like when you lose it in a meeting. But it can be also at work without anyone raising their voices when it takes the form of the inappropriate use of power. The precepts represent the antidotes to the three poisons. They are the practical skills that embody the generosity, the compassion, and the understanding which will counteract greed, anger, and ignorance. So let's look at one of the precepts and see how it operates in a church conflict as a diffuser of a charged situation and to help it move towards resolution. The one that I'd like to focus on in the list is see the perfection, do not speak of others' errors and faults. This precept connects to one of the Eight Noble Truths, which is right speech. And like all the precepts, it's framed in both a negative and positive advice. The negative advice is not to speak about other people with whom you are in conflict in harsh and negative ways. No name calling, no character assassination, no backstabbing. This is something that is, you know, hard enough to do when you're in a public context of debate or discussion, when you get really angry at somebody in the church who you thought you had a good relationship with and who is strongly disagreeing with you. It's even harder to do if you need to argue your case in a more sort of private setting with a third party in the church whose support you are seeking or with whom you are asking help. And it's hardest to do privately when you're talking to your partner or your best friend in your own home about how difficult this conflict is for you and when you really need to vent about the people that are creating it, or at least that you identify are creating it other than you. That's when the positive aspect of the precept comes in. See the perfection. This phrase means that throughout the conflict, you are trying to hold in your heart the possibility that the person who opposes you does have the best interests of the church at heart in the same way that you do, and the possibility that neither of you are self-absorbed, power-hungry jerks, but that you each have a different vision of what is best for the church. For persons who are asked to mediate or consult on church conflict, seeing the perfection is in many ways what they get trained to do, as an exercise in staying neutral and not jumping to judgment about how the conflict could or should be resolved. And for these people, it can be harder in a different way to avoid speaking of others' errors and faults because, you know, part of your training, if you're involved in mediation or conflict resolution, is analysis. You inevitably do some of that. You're looking at where each party in the conflict could change their behavior or step back from a position that has a particularly sharp point and is wounding the other people who are involved. The advice that you are able to give on how to step back does need to involve clarity about how the parties in the conflict could change. But it is also necessary for mediators and for people who are in a more neutral position and seeking resolution in a church conflict to not get caught up in the emotions of the conflict yourself. And as frustrations involved in moving slowly towards resolution mount, avoiding the infection of that emotional intensity is a really good thing to be able to do. So seeing the perfection is a good meditation that helps that. You probably have heard the story that circulates on the internet that is sometimes attributed to the Cherokee Nation. I have no idea whether that's true at all. But it describes in various versions that we have two wolves fighting inside us, one that represents negative and positive tendencies. And the point of the story is the wolf that triumphs will be the wolf you feed. This metaphor works to illustrate this precept. Refraining from negative speech in a conflict, even privately, helps feed the right wolf. Seeing the perfection means that you recognize that any two creatures that are fighting are beautiful beings, each of whom has Buddha nature. It's not the magic trick that is going to make the conflict turn out all right, but whether you are in the conflict or mediating the conflict, it is a precept that can sustain health and happiness in at least one person, you, as you strive towards resolution. So I'd like to invite Janine to come up now. I think you're going to be second and do a little bit of reflection for us, and then we'll turn it over to Rick.
Could you light our chalice for us?
Oh, Wayne? I forgot all
That's
about
okay,
that.
That's okay, because
I'm so
it's
bad.
Always the right moment to light the chalice, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I'll give you these words by way of a chalice lighting. If we could really penetrate the truth about impermanence, our life would be lived very differently. We could live with more joy and spontaneity, able to rejoice in the continuously emerging wonder of life. We could learn to flow with life's ups and downs because we know them to be changing situations. It is not that life changes, but that change is the very essence of life. Change and impermanence are the fundamental characteristics of life, which we need to learn to be in harmony with in order to be free and untroubled. Some people may be frightened to investigate or accept change, yet the joy and freedom which come from realizing the truth of change far surpass the mundane happiness of holding on to illusions and dreams. Change is life. Change is the wonder of life. These are the words of Ajahn Tiradamo. So I'm Janine Larson. I am a Seattle resident and native. And as Wayne noted, I'm a member also of the UUA Congregational Life staff here in the Pacific Northwest, having served on field staff for the UUA since 2004. In this work, as you might imagine, supporting congregations facing conflict is something of a constant. And that's not always a bad thing, because conflict engaged productively and compassionately can help open the door to that which needs to be born. The important thing to realize about conflict is that it is a regular marker of change. And what does Buddhism teach about change or impermanence? That human suffering arises from our desire to have things be other than they are, to cling to things we are desperate to keep, and to run away from things we are desperate to change. So what else is truth about change? It is also necessary to growth. And that's the reason congregational conflict is so often related to or triggered by growth, as it is realized or imagined, and also why we have as humans such a complicated and complex response to the whole idea of congregational growth. People tend to live along a spectrum of change-friendly and change-averse. That's the reason congregational conflict arises in such interesting and dynamic ways in our congregations. I have seen that the most consistently extreme change responses tend to be from those who have experienced a lot of change, conflict, or trauma in childhood. Among these are people who seem to create chaos wherever they go, including in our congregations. I invite you to consider that they may be simply trying to recreate a familiar pattern so they can feel secure. Interestingly, this is also the same for those who are exceptionally risk averse or change averse. They may be doing all they can to avoid a familiar pattern of uncontrolled, unpredictable change that has made them feel extremely unsafe. Conflict patterns in congregations are often traceable several generations back to the conflict style of an early minister, for example, or a founding member. These inherited patterns are subtly passed down generation to generation and tend to influence the choice of subsequent ministers and leaders. Usually, these having the same characteristics and same patterns of conflict styles, for better or for worse. In addition, the predominant change or conflict responses of a long time recent minister or prominent lay leaders also tend to be reflected in the makeup and the temperament of the entire staff team, as well as in the behaviors of the current congregation as a whole. Members tend to self-select over the years based on the recognition of familiar patterns, conflict and change response primary among them. Congregations, like individuals, seek stability, a threat to the congregation's comfort zone, and the risk or change scale of the congregation. Any threat to that can trigger conflict to arise very quickly. Even in a large congregation, the introduction of a very few new members or staff who have a different relationship to change can upset congregational harmony very rapidly. This can be particularly true when a chaos-seeking individual enters a congregation with a very conflict-averse culture or leadership style. There may be tension that smolders in the background unnoticed for a long time here or for a period of time, but it will tend to burst forth at some point, seemingly out of nowhere. My 15-year Zen Buddhist practice has helped me better understand and come into right relationship with my own change dynamics and to meet the change and conflict dynamics of others with more equanimity and compassion. I have learned to make it a practice to empty my teacup, before I step into a room, particularly when I'm walking into a place steeped with high emotion. This empty my teacup image comes from the story of a prospective student who was trying to impress the teacher by recounting all the study experiences and intellectual analysis of Buddhism. The teacher, listening, began making tea for the two of them, heating water, measuring the tea, stirring, nodding, pouring tea into the student's cup. The teacher quietly continued pouring as the cup filled and began to overflow. Soon tea was spilling all over the tray and the floor. And finally, the self-impressed student noticed. "Stop, stop," said the student. "The cup is full. It won't hold anymore." The teacher did stop pouring the tea then and replied calmly, "You are like this cup. You are full of ideas about the Buddha's way. You come and ask for teaching, but your cup is full. I can't put anything in. Before I can teach you, you'll have to empty your cup." Each encounter with anxiety, conflict, and anger is an opportunity for our own learning, which must exist simultaneously before any teaching or presence can occur. So our core practice in being with what is to empty our teacups. Spiritual practice is like a health tonic. And when a congregation teaches and supports active spiritual practice as a norm for its individuals and families, there is always a turn towards health, harmony, and interestingly, growth. We become more change-friendly because the terror of the unknown begins to have less power over us. We begin to accept things as they are, and if we simply welcome each moment, the wisdom already existing within each of us can be brought to bear with more ease and grace. Practicing with the Buddhist precepts as guidelines for ethical living is an invitation to really dig into your own patterns and consciously increase skillfulness in your responses to life. I've chosen two of the precepts to help illustrate how helpful this practice with the precepts can be in engaging change and internal and interpersonal distress and conflict that change presents. So the fourth precept on Wayne's handout, and for those who came late, we did not have enough handouts for everyone. It's so wonderful to see so many of you here. Yay, peeps. So if you have had the chance to read the precepts and no longer need the handout, maybe you can just pass it back and others can see that too. So the fourth precept on this handout is stated simply as manifest the truth, do not lie. Most of us have some understanding of the do not lie part, but there is a more nuanced view. Reb Anderson, the senior teacher and former abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center, teaches in his book, Being Upright, Zen Meditation and the Bodhisattva Precepts, that while the conventional meaning of lie is to speak with the intention to deceive and to misrepresent, withhold, or hide some aspect of the whole truth, a deeper practice with this precept encourages us to extend the meaning of not lying to include not speaking in a false or harmful way, or standing by in silence while others speak in a false or harmful way. So, I always perk up my ears when I hear that this or that person is just speaking her truth, or when I witness a blistering diatribe and observe everyone in the room just sitting in silence afterwards, often saying to me in confidence later, that is just his way. Reb Anderson points out that those who find success by manipulating the truth steadily begin to lose sight of what truth actually is. It becomes relative to what serves their own interest. And after a little while, this self-deception smooths the path of deceiving others. We lie more convincingly if we are lying first to ourselves, says Reb. In assessing conflict in the congregation, this precept encourages us to really test the influence of our own self-interest in shading the truth. It is sometimes very helpful to seek outside perspectives in assessing the complex congregational culture and norms that tolerate or empower those who manipulate the truth for self-gain, whether they realize it or not. Noticing patterns and gaining several perspectives is a useful tool. The other part of the, I'm missing something. When we consider these patterns of lying, of not being with the truth, of harmful behavior and speech in our congregations, we can see that truth is manipulated in order to achieve a particular agenda, or where the congregation may have fallen victim to intimidation by those whose verbal attacks are cloaked in righteousness. When we decline to counter harmful speech or acts, the leadership and the entire congregation becomes complicit with bullying and oppression. So the other part of the fourth precept, manifest the truth, also begs attention, because what does that actually mean? It means having the courage to show up as the precept, as the teaching, being fully present as one who lives compassionate truth and witness in every moment. It also means that we are living out all of the other precepts because they are all interconnected. For example, Reb Anderson reminds us that those who engage in sexual misconduct and addiction to intoxicants are also actively engaged in lying and deceit, both in speech and in action. He says the hallmark of abusive and addictive behavior is that we feel we have to lie about it. I'd also like to raise up the 10th precept, experience the intimacy of things. Do not defile the three treasures, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. What this is saying is to not separate yourself from the oneness, the integrity of the three treasures. Things are not separate from your own self, and to see self and other outside of oneness is to lose the experience of intimacy with life, the intimacy of the present moment. We defile the teacher, the truth, and the community by holding a view of ourselves as somehow able to be separate. But I've also seen this precept become more confounding and create even more troubling results, even disastrous results, if it's interpreted too simply and too literally. Sometimes this precept is misunderstood to mean that one must never disagree with the teacher, with a specific view of the Dharma, or with the positions of the Sangha. This misguided understanding of loyalty and respect is what leads to the cover-up of clergy misconduct, violence, and judging that is committed in the name of religion, or the unfortunate phenomenon of groupthink that ultimately subverts honesty and necessary reflection, and therefore the better decisions on any thorny subject that comes before a congregation, the board, or a committee. Instead, this precept reminds us to bring our deep faith, our confidence, our deep doubt, curiosity, and our deep determination to our investigations of the truth. These are known as the three pillars of Zen: deep faith, deep doubt, and deep determination. They're very applicable to conflict engagement and to Unitarian Universalism, for that matter. We may think we know, but we must always look more deeply. We must stick to the matter and not be put off track by the hurdles and barriers such as untruthfulness, delusion, diversion in ourselves and others. Faith, doubt, and determination are companions of the quest for truth in the living tradition of Unitarian Universalism and in this very moment of Buddhism. As we encounter conflict, let us be guided by the precepts, and let us remember this teaching koan. Student, When times of great difficulty visit us, how should we greet them? Teacher, welcome.
When I first began my ministry about almost three decades ago in 1986, I knew for sure that my Dharma vacation was over. Don't bother to Google that term because you won't get any results. It's a term I invented. But let me explain. Some years earlier in my 20s, I had begun a meditation practice with some very serious-minded Zen Buddhist communities in San Francisco and in Washington, D.C., and I surely benefited from the spiritual grounding that I got in those spiritual communities, but I was just this young guy, and I wasn't used to meditating, and all of a sudden I was sitting sesshins. You know what those are? Sesshins are intensive meditation retreats where you sit, and then you sit, and then you sit, and you sit, and you sit, and your legs get painful. It's just really, really hard to bear. And I sat on some sesshins, and I recognized that it was a good thing, but I also recognized it was a very daunting thing. And so a few years later, when I returned to undergraduate school to complete my degree, and I wasn't around anybody who was seriously practicing, the spiritual slacker in me went out for several years. And so I declared to a bemused Buddhist buddy on me that I was taking a little Dharma vacation. You know, some time away from the teachings and practices of Buddhism. I know Christians would call this backsliding. But I like to put a positive spin on almost anything. Truth be told, I was really never at peace during my Dharma vacation. And a few years later, when I was finally through theology school and saw the Ministerial Fellowship Committee and was about to enter my ministry, I knew my Dharma vacation was over. I needed to get back on my meditation cushion. I couldn't be the minister I felt called to be if I was neglecting my own spiritual life. And so I made a vow to myself. From here on out, I will meditate every day. One decision, one vow. I've never questioned it. It's one of the smartest decisions I've ever made. I'm really embarrassed about the level of my practice, however, after 30 years. I'm not what you would call an advanced meditator, but I am patient, and I'm persistent, and I'm dedicated to this practice, and I can testify that you will change. You will change if you engage in this practice. Think not of you're going to sit down for 15 minutes, follow your breath, and wake up a transformed being. Maybe you will. I'm happy for you if that happens. But think more about a drop of water falling on a stone. Think how long it takes to carve that stone. That's how my practice feels to me. But I stick with it. And I think that anybody, I really do, in fact, I'm convinced of it, anybody can experience transformative benefits if you do have a practice. Another wise decision I decided when I came to Salem, Oregon, nearby Salem, Oregon, 23 years ago, was to start a meditation group. And then some years into that experience, I was joined by my good friend, Sensei An, Leanne Nail. Are you here today, Leanne? There she is. You see her back there? Pay attention to that wonderful lady. She'll have good things to tell you about. She's the founder of the Salem Zen Center. She's a member of my congregation. She's our teacher, and she convenes our Wednesday night sitting group. So every Wednesday night in my congregation, there's a group of us that gather, and we meditate. We needed Leanne to join us to really get us on track. And then she gives us a Dharma talk afterwards. So I think it's an epical thing that Buddhism and Unitarian Universalism are flowing together. We have so much in common, and I'm really excited to be alive during the time when this is happening. The reason I'm mentioning my practice today is because of the way it has influenced how I encounter conflict, which, as you know from hearing from Wayne and Janine and from your own experience probably, it's an inevitable. Don't think you're going to be in congregational life and be able to avoid conflict, or life in general. It's an inevitable aspect of congregational life, and I have sorely needed the grounding that meditation provides me, because I think most people who would know me would agree that I have I veer on the conflict avoidance side of things. I would prefer there was no conflict, but there is, always is. And my default impulse is to avoid it. But then I hear the sage voice of Emerson. You know how you get these quotes and they take up permanent lodging in your soul? It's really great when that happens. And this one from Emerson stays with me. Do the thing you fear, and the death of fear is certain. Do the thing you fear, and the death of fear is certain. Psychologists more prosaically call this exposure training. And you can get a good bit of conflict and experience in your ministry or as a congregational leader. And if you are open to it, you can see it as an opportunity for growth and just another aspect of our lives together. We're speaking today of Buddhist ethics and how this applies to conflict. And this ethical grounding arises not from heeding the dictates of an inscrutable God or following what some sacred text tells you you should do. It's nice that we do have the Buddhist ethics, they're written down, but really, really, it arises from our own personal awareness of consequences. Does something cause suffering, or does it benefit others? Simply put, if something damages you and others, it's to be avoided, and if something benefits you and others, it's to be embraced. What I've discovered is that a meditation practice, even if you don't feel like you're any good at it, that's, I talk to a lot of people and they say, I tried meditation and I couldn't quiet my mind, and I'm thinking, you don't try to quiet your mind in meditation, by the way, that's not the point of it, but even if you don't think you're good at it, you probably are experiencing more benefit than you realize. And it helps create more spaciousness. More spaciousness, it means you have more of an opportunity to become aware of that which damages relations and that which can help you and others avoid unnecessary suffering. Or to put it another way, meditation or mindfulness or centering prayer, something that grounds you and centers you, it slows you down, and it helps you from driving too fast and recklessly on the interpersonal highway of congregational relations. Sometimes it's a lot of speeding going on there. A centering practice helps you slow down, stay grounded. It does mean that you're less likely to fly off the road into destructive realms of emotional reactivity as you go around the many tight curves on this highway. And then two, this is one of the benefits of a practice that I really never thought about, and I'm embarrassed to admit that, but it happens anyway. As you practice more, you feel more compassion for every person because you're slowing down. Something happens and you feel more compassion for every body in the world, and you're not likely to bear ill, you don't want to bear ill will towards anyone. And this is very congruent with our universalist theology, which preaches that God doesn't condemn anyone to hell, and I think that's also an invitation for us to do likewise. So let's take a short test drive using Buddhist ethics as our spiritual positioning system, if you will. You ready? Let's go. Here we go into a potential conflict zone in congregational life. There's a meeting. Some important business is being discussed. Things are beginning to get a little bit heated because people are seeing things differently. And alas, it looks like some strong personalities who see things differently than you do are going to prevail. And this is an important matter. And so you don't want that to happen, because you don't think that what they want is the right thing. And so you begin to push back equally hard, because you're pretty sure you've got it right and they don't. They've got it all wrong. So early stages of a shoving match, maybe it's time to check in with your Buddhist ethics positioning system. Slow down. Take a breath. Why don't you do it right now? Just take a breath. Anytime you're in a stressful situation, you can do that. You actually can. You can actually meditate right before a conflict. I found that to be you can try, and that's a good time to try. Slow down, center yourself, find some space, re-enter the conversation. Maybe this time with some humility. And you remember, the point here is not for your personal opinion to win out. The point here is for the truth to prevail in as much as possible. And so you offer some words to your so-called, those you are seeing as your adversaries. Let's see if we can figure this out together. I think I have a piece of the truth here, but you know what? I've often been wrong about things, and I appreciate it if you would help me recognize my personal blind spots. But let's also consider this. We may both be right. Just because we hold opposite views on the matter before us doesn't mean that one of us has to be right and the other wrong. And oftentimes in congregational settings, two truths need to be held in creative tension, such as the need to ground ourselves in tradition and be open to innovation, or to be practical and be visionary. If you're just one and not the other of those things, and you don't hold them in creative tension, you'll have difficulty in congregational life. And in advising you to consider this, I'm informed by a conflict management technique which Janine helped introduce to the Healthy Congregations team in our district. You may have heard of it before. How many of you have heard of polarity management? It's a wonderful thing to study it. You can Google that, and you'll see many results. Polarity management really does help you be able to identify polarities in congregational conflicts, and you recognize we don't want either side to prevail absolutely. We need to hold these in creative tension to name the polarities. I'm also ethically guided in my deliberations here. We're on this test drive through a conflict zone. I'm ethically guided by the notion that I and my temporary adversary are really, in the deepest sense, we're one, really. We're one. Buddhist teaching liberates us from the illusion that we are separate, isolated beings. I love the way the Buddhist teacher Thich Nhat Hanh, what a blessing he's been to Western society. I love the way Thich Nhat Hanh describes our common being. This is a word that should enter all our vocabularies, interbeing. We inter are. Very congruent with our Unitarian Universalist interdependent web of all existence. With this realization in mind that really we are one, you have the opportunity to be on guard against inordinate attachment to your own views and desperate, small self-validating notions that you must be right. One of the most common pitfalls in interpersonal dynamics is the idolatry of self, the conviction that because you think and feel a certain way, then you must be right. How could you be wrong? Because you feel so strongly and you have these opinions. And when you do this, now I'm finally, you thought I wasn't even going to talk about the ethics that you got handed out. When you do this idolatry of self, you elevate yourself above others. Contrarywise, it's just as problematic if, in an act of self-abasement, you elevate others above yourself. Janine mentioned that in the relationship with the teacher. Very briefly, I just want to describe another helpful Quaker-inspired technique, which was also taught by the Healthy Congregations team to my congregation. And it helps us to liberate discussions from the perils of egotistic entrenchment, where people become personally identified with a particular point of view. This is my position. This is my position. This technique creates conditions for a higher level of collective discernment to occur. And here's how it works. Suppose you're discussing something that's a big change in your congregation. For a few years ago, we discussed in my congregation whether we should move to two Sunday services. Scary, scary conversations. Here's what we tried to do, and somehow I think we sort of did it, but we learned the technique from the Healthy Congregations team. You get a small group of people, you have conversations, eight or so people, and you say, here's what we're talking about today, moving to two services or whatever, big decision, buying land or calling a minister or whatever, I don't know. You have everybody go around and speak. Everybody speaks. There's about 30 seconds of silence between. You have a facilitator taking notes. First thing you do, you say, we want everybody to speak against this. Everybody. No exceptions. You all have to say why this is a bad idea. Let's have it. Let's just get it all out. Everybody speaks against it. Everybody surely has some misgivings. Even if you're in favor of something, you'll still have misgivings. Facilitator writes those ideas on the board. Said, did I get it all? Okay. Those are the reasons we shouldn't do this. Now let's discuss why we might do it, why we should do it. Same exact process. Everybody speaks in favor of it. A moment of silence, about 30 seconds. The facilitator is taking good notes. And everybody speaks. Nobody's attached or identified with a particular position. You are engaged in a process of collective discernment. I think that so much of the conflict in our congregations could be avoided, not avoided, but handled more skillfully if we simply introduce good processes for collective discernment and get into less of this ego battle stuff. This is my position, that's your position, one of us has to win. So that's just a couple of techniques that I was so grateful to learn from the Healthy Congregations team, and thank you, Janine, for working so hard to make that happen in our district. This process doesn't always work like a charm. I mean, sometimes a cell phone goes off in the middle of the, while you're trying to have a moment of peace, but you just go with it. These are just a couple of the techniques whose end is to create auspicious conditions where people are less inclined to fall into the trap of fanatical or destructive attachment to their own opinions, and more likely to practice the precept of not elevating the self or blaming others, scapegoating them. I never trust that energy in myself. Not only does this help us avoid destructive conflict, there's constructive conflict, necessary conflict, but there's also destructive conflict. The processes I just described, I think, create conditions for collective wisdom to be discerned. Too often, I think, those with the most forceful extroverted personalities or those who are perceived to have the most power may leave others feeling overwhelmed and powerless, thus subverting our democratic principle of sharing power. In our Unitarian Universalist congregations, we affirm democratic process, and we are called to create the conditions wherein each person feels genuinely powered, and each person feels like they do have a voice. We are called to be together in life-affirming ways, and you and I can't control what others will bring to the table, but I have discovered that through a practice of meditation or centering yourself, of learning to let go of destructive trains of thought that cause you and others to suffer, we can help our congregations on their journeys toward creating beloved communities. Lay and ordained religious leaders are called to bring our most compassionate and open-hearted selves to the table as we move forward on this goal. I think I probably talked longer than 15 minutes, but.
Yeah, you did, but that's all right. Thanks, Rick. I think it would be really good before we go into questions and response from you if we took just 2 minutes to sit. Those of you who had your quick lunch before coming in here can use this for your power nap if that is the right thing to do. And those of you who are have been listening to a lot of words can have 2 minutes to just see what comes up, see what surfaces out of all of this bubbling reflection, and see what might be the question you want to ask. So let's just take 2 minutes. So now the floor is yours for response, for reflection, for questions to any of us. The microphone in the center is what we need to use in order for this to be properly recorded. Its height may not be set for you. Feel free to lift that the back stick, you know, that's holding it up. To lower it. Great.
Hi.
Hi.
I am just wondering if I were to try to incorporate some of this in myself and interact with others that do not, how do you approach it if you are trying to do some of these, this approach to life, but the people that you might be working with are not in that same frame of mind? Does
sure.
that make sense? Oh, I'm Jane Beckel. I'm from Bellingham, Washington.
Thanks, Jane. My quick response is that trying to be an instant teacher to somebody else didactically rarely works, so that embodying it yourself and trying to bring a different presence into the conflict or into the room is most effective.
That's exactly what I was going to say, so I don't need to say it again.
I'm Kirtland Davies from Ormond Beach. Many of our congregations use majority vote, and I was just wondering how you get around that, because we've had many votes where 49% of us go away feeling like we haven't been heard. Mm-hmm. So how do you deal with that? Thank you.
One of the things that I recommend is for the congregation to recognize that there's a difference between dialogue and learning and taking a vote. So I always encourage congregations to have a period of time where there are many opportunities to discuss the issue before you get to the point where you're going to vote. That way you're not trying to educate people moments before they have to vote on it. And everyone then has the opportunity to feel heard and to express themselves. So that can be very helpful.
And the other problem is you have a small board deciding these huge issues. How do you include the rest of the congregation?
Yeah. Same thing with the board. I always recommend to our congregations, particularly when there's a difficult or controversial topic coming up, and even when it's just kind of a non-controversial topic, like should we have our scheduled annual meeting, have those same kinds of informational meetings. A lot of our congregations have begun to have regular times where there's conversation with the board, like come have lunch with the board or coffee with the board or something like that. And the more dialogue you're able to have ahead of time, people begin to understand that there is trust and begin to understand that questions can be answered and asked, that nothing's being hidden. So the vote then just becomes, yeah, this is our point of agreement. It may not be 100%, but at least you feel like you've been heard and that people care enough to seek that out.
There's a wonderful fellowship not too far from here in McMinnville, Oregon. Is there anybody here from McMinnville this morning?
Way
in the back. They, I love that fellowship, and we have a good relationship with them. They were in conversation about whether to have a minister about 5 years ago, and I was at a small meeting where it was 18 in favor and 12 against, and they didn't go with that majority vote. They had conversations for years and years and years, and they are now calling you a quarter-time minister, but big decisions should not be rammed down the minority vote. You've got to say if you've got that kind of a split, it needs to continue. That conversation needs to continue.
So painful divided votes often are a result of the tyranny of time. And sometimes the tyranny of time can be overcome simply by letting go of a deadline that has been really artificially imposed. I know it's, you know, the 25th of the month is the board meeting, and that's when we have to decide. But do you really? And how much would it hurt to have another congregational conversation? People who feel like losers most often feel like they haven't been heard, not that they lost the vote. Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, I'm Rita Chamblin from First UU, Lubbock, Texas. And you talked earlier about damaging speech, often intimidation, which is cloaked in righteousness, and our responsibility, perhaps, to deal with that at the moment or the time that it's happening. Can you give me an example of how to do that with right speech?
I'll give you a chance to have a wiser response than mine. I just have a very simple thing. I'm not good at this myself, but I was at a board meeting and it was getting a little heated, and associate minister at the time, something got a little out of hand, and all she did was say, "Ouch." She named it, and it wasn't recognized by the person who was speaking intemperately, and so now you guys weigh in. Do you have anything to add to that?
One of the things that I often recommend when emotional content becomes high and the feeling becomes high in a meeting like that, call for a time of silence and a time to remember our covenant with one another, to love one another and to respect one another and to speak respectfully, and then just let silence happen for a while, and inevitably people will start a little calmer. Do that as many times as you need to until that calmness and love for one another can really emerge and be present.
My biggest problem is with reactive anger that I am not aware of, because I'm so into hearing in my head my right position, and I'm not aware of what's mounting in my body that is going to explode into words that I have not considered, that I didn't predict. And so if I can pay attention to how my body is feeling and get in touch with that, that's usually the way that I can let that body feeling go, and that helps clear my mind and get me into a better place to not do the words that I'm going to wish I didn't say 2 minutes later.
Hi, my name is Jean Helms. I'm from Lincoln, Nebraska. I'm the administrative director there, and I wanted to, as best I could, listen and not write as I was listening today. And I would like to take some of what I heard back to our Sangha, and I'm wondering if your materials are going to be available on the website or if I could get them some other way.
Well, we all preached from text or whatever we did today. And so we have the text, and we have a recording of this that is part of the General Assembly's recorded workshops. And that would be the most quick and efficient. I suppose, Sam, we could get these up on the website. We could put them together and post them on.
On that Buddhist Fellowship website, but it could be the GA website will also let us post written comments, too, and that would be helpful. I thought so. Excellent.
Okay.
Coming soon to a screen near you.
Do you think you can lift your, pull it down just a bit.
I'm Elizabeth Copley from Walnut Creek, Mount Diablo Unitarian Church in California. This is reverse of righteousness, that you were talking about reacting to somebody who's righteous. What if, I can't just disagree if I think that somebody's responding in a morally unethical way. How should I not be righteous, but deal with something that I totally disagree with?
You see our little figure up here in front of the chalice. Those of you in the very back may have to imagine it because she's about this tall.
Me?
No.
And the answer is yes. That's absolutely right, because
it's all about me.
Isn't it, though? Consider this figure of Kuan Yin, this goddess and bodhisattva of compassion. And I remember that we are not separate. And I remember myself as the goddess of compassion, the bodhisattva. And I bring that to my language before I open my mouth. And that's very, very helpful. It's your own moment of silence. You give yourself the gift of time out in that good, productive way.
I had just one little thing to add to that. I'm not really good at morally upbraiding people. I can't think of times where I run into so much in my congregation where I'm thinking people are acting immorally and just wrong and I really need to stop them from doing it. It's more acting hastily or angrily and inviting them to slow down. But if there's a situation where somebody in your congregation is really acting immorally, and it has to be named and confronted and dealt with. And if it's destructive behavior, then something has to be done. It's not just between you and that person. There should be some ways to engage key leaders in awareness. If there was sexual abuse or financial impropriety or something or so.
I'm David Tucker. I'm from the Eno River UU Fellowship in Durham, North Carolina. And thank you very much for doing this panel and this session. Can you hear me better now?
Yeah, that's right. Good. Getting
sorry
closer.
About that. I'm David Tucker. I'm from Eno River UU Fellowship in Durham, North Carolina. I am about to start in a few days as a member of our Board of Trustees for a three-year term. And from attending some meetings of the current board, the outgoing board. The board and the lead minister are adopting an annual vision of ministry that's going to revolve around covenant, looking at covenant, how to live together covenantally, and so on. I think it's going to be a wonderful year and a wonderful process. It's also likely that at some point during that year, the upcoming year, we'll look for a process whereby we can, as a congregation, for the first time, adopt a written covenant for the congregation. I think it highly likely this will bring up some choppy white waters and some conflict.
Mm-hmm.
I think it will still be worth doing as a process, regardless of what the outcome ultimately turns out to be. But a lot will hinge upon, is it a good process or a bad process? Do people feel heard? And when their wounded places come up, as I think will likely happen, how do we deal with that? So, long story short, I'm wondering what, especially from the Buddhist teachings, but any other techniques you know, what comes to mind to y'all about how we might, in anticipation of potential conflict there, be ready to handle it skillfully and have a good process around it?
So that's a really big question, of course.
I realize that.
And we're going to have 1 minute to answer it. So that's why I'm going to give it to Janine.
So, you know, this process of covenanting with one another is so important to us in Unitarian Universalism. It's so important to all of us in life for world peace and peace in ourselves and our small communities. So this is not an unknown process. Talk to other board members about how that has gone in their congregation, particularly if this is the first time you've engaged a covenanting process. Ask your minister to do the same with the colleagues. And learn about it yourselves and engage it openly and fully with the congregation before you get to that meeting where you're having the vote. Right, so you understand why are we doing this. And also, if you find that it is in fact a time that you are seeing active conflict in your congregation, put off that process. Don't engage that process during a conflict, because that will do you no good, I've seen.
So let me tell you what I'm going to do about the commercials. I've limited those to less than 5 minutes. This workshop allegedly ends at 2:30. There is a half-hour transition time to the start of the next one in the same room. Our good friends from the UUUN are going to a climate change workshop, and I want to respect their time. We could probably spill over a little bit for those of you who want to stay, and we could keep answering questions for a few minutes longer after I do the commercials. But I want to do the commercials and then release people who need to go to their next workshop, okay? So the commercials start with asking the UU Buddhist Fellowship board members who are here to stand up so that you know who they are and can speak with them privately about our adventures in UUBF. We have Florence Kaplow, who is the new consulting minister in Carbondale, Colorado. And we have Meredith Garman, who is the minister in White Plains, New York. We have Sam Trumbore, who is minister in Albany. We have Rick Davis, who you've met already, and me. So any of them can talk with you a little bit more about our activities. We particularly want, and you can sign up on the table near the doors on your way out for being on email communication lists. We have an occasional publication, and its occasionalness depends on how many of us submit articles for it. So, you know, we're a little loose about time. And we are planning and looking for a good site on the West Coast and probably in the Pacific Northwest for a spring 2017 UUBF convocation. Our last convocation featured as our teacher for the weekend, Robert Stephen Batchelor. So we've been able to attract a variety of teachers from different traditions. We've had Tara Brack, we've had James Ford, we've had Shenzhen Young. So every 2 years, we do a pretty amazing and special convocation. If you're a West Coast person here and we get more, we'd really like you to consider paying attention to that in the spring of 2017, and we, Sam, others near the table would welcome your suggestions for retreat centers or conference centers that can accommodate 60 to 120 people in meditation that have cushion supplies to be able to help us with that and are in some proximity to an airport. So I think, and there is a copy of UU Buddhist Voices back there, which because you came to this, and they're my copies, I will sell you at the discounted price of $10, which is a really good price if you look at the list price. I will only take cash or for that price, or I will take a check payable to myself, Wayne Arneson, A-R-N-A-S-O-N. All right, only 10 of them. All right, more questions.
Okay. I'll see if I can be fast. My name's Marcia Stevenson from North Shore Unitarian Church in North Vancouver, BC, Canada. I'm going back on a board. I was listening really carefully to the section about people's approaches to being change averse and comfortable with change. We're in ministerial transition. There's a lot of change going on, and I'm also aware that we have some long simmering conflict over what we believe about things. So I'm wondering how does one start to surface those conflicts if you're thinking that, wow, maybe this is going to let the, you know, all of Pandora's box is going to open and all those little things are going to fly out. And is that going to be too much for us to handle?
Do you have an interim minister at this
time?
We
will have.
We'll have an interim minister.
She's already been called and has agreed, yeah.
Yeah. The first thing to do is to speak to the interim minister and see if she has her own ways of managing that in congregations as she gets to know them. And that can be helpful, because here's somebody who's kind of an outsider who will also be there with you in continuity for a while. So that's good. I'm not familiar now if the CUC still has field staff or a Western regional consultant.
Yeah.
Check with those people, too, for additional resources. That's what I'd recommend for you right now. But definitely interim time is a perfect time to engage that, and most interims are trained and ready to help with that process.
Okay. You know, and some of the things that we've talked about in the formal talks, opportunities for people to reflect on the history of the congregation, some of their own storytelling about their roles in it, some of the things that have been difficult in the past. Understand where you've come from. Janine's comments about people coming out of old wounds sometimes when they're in a current conflict. Having safe spaces for people to have that kind of conversation, I think, can help understanding the fellowship's history. Yeah. Okay, we got two more. Thanks, everybody, for your quiet conversation in the back as we continue to answer these questions, and there is space in the hall to do it, too.
Thank you all for what you've offered this afternoon. My name is Victor Asher, and I'm part of a small fellowship in northern Wyoming called the Sheridan UU Fellowship, and I also have a question about covenanting. Since we're lay-led, we members give talks, so I gave a talk on covenanting with the thought that we might engage in conversation about it over a period of a year, and then suggested that we might have small groups meet in different people's houses to talk about, you know, this issue, pro or con, whatever. Leaving it very open, we had four groups of people that met in different people's houses. One of the groups chose not to even discuss the subject. And I'm just curious what thoughts you might have about how that could have been handled. Thanks.
Gee, you know, I don't know how the facilitation was organized and what kind of training the facilitators of those four different groups had, and, you know, how what the context was of that fourth group. I think the larger issue is, in a way, what Janine was pointing to in her talk about people whose agenda puts them in a position of resistance and perhaps even organized resistance to an effort towards conversation, health, or change. We won't kid you that that's not a tough nut to crack, especially if they're well organized, have money, have history, have strong voices. The one conversation at a time comment that I made about people feeling like they've been listened to is a melting technique, and you wish that there were faster ways or more efficient or more rational ways to do it than seeing if you can sit down with the people who are struggling with the direction you want to go and really trying to open your heart to them and where they are. But it seems to me that that's the best advice from this Buddhist lens perspective. Okay, we're going to take two more. And
hi. My name is Marcia Kristen, and I'm part of a Healthy Congregations implementation team in Bremerton, Washington. Mm-hmm. And I was just really thankful for the resources you gave today. And I'm excited about some things we may be bringing to ours. I thought I would share is looking at collaborative decision making, which is kind of efficient consensus decision making for some of the people who asked before. And also we found that we might be bringing in some seven principles project, which is like nonviolent communication and looking at how we live the principles into our congregation, so that might be a resource. I'll let you know how it goes. I have found that nonviolent communication has been a spiritual practice that's really added to my mindfulness and meditation practice. So if we see that as a practice rather than this thing and language we do, so I thought I would offer that. And thank you so much on the UUA, all the resources I'm finding on this team. So that was it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Last one, and then we've got a setup here that needs
to
happen.
I'm Ann Thorward from Monte Vista Church in Claremont, California. And I must have missed a beat here trying to find the room, but you have a healthy congregations team. Well, how many healthy congregations are there, and how do we know if we are one?
So all of our congregations are healthy. Some are just needing a little bit of boost in their health, so I believe. Yeah, you know, this Healthy Congregations team, the Pacific Northwest District, started to help congregations into better health, to understand healthy communications, good patterns, proactive engagement of conflict before it turns harmful. So that's what that process is.
Thank you so much for coming, everyone, and we appreciate your presence, and we'll let the room transition here.
Great job, Wayne.
Thank you.
I'll need to collect your texts, okay? I'll need your texts.
Okay. One quick story. You were talking about the 49-51% votes in MHP.
Oh, yes.
We had a minister who
yes, that's a good to kind of share that. It shows that you understand. It's a good technique. It can be manipulated, so it's good to have some skill in doing that so that people don't get reactive.
And they had it all set and they're told that they're under control.
Hi.
But I was.